more. Baby, it's not nice. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it, come in no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are. Grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a lot we're going to be covering this evening, but we're going to start off with an NPR clip describing Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley, who happened to be the first FDA director. And his life is very interesting, and this is we're going to give a little history here about these early fighters, you know, against the food industries, which has become humongous along with the drug industries. But anyway, this is about Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley. I also have a download for his book. So listen to this, see what you think.
We're going to take you back now to the late 1800s, when eating food in the U.S. meant taking a calculated risk. The country was growing, people were moving into cities, and industrialization gave food producers new, sometimes dangerous ways to stretch their products.
They were very inventive with fakery back then because there were no rules against it, right? It's completely legal to do whatever.
That's author Deborah Blum. Her new book explores that era before the U.S. enacted food safety rules. My co-host, Ari Shapiro, talked with her about it.
The book is called The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. I started by asking Deborah Blum what someone living around 1900 might find in everyday foods like coffee, candy, or milk.
Milk was a great example of just how bad things could get for a number of reasons. One, dairymen seeking to sort of stretch their profits would thin it with water. It wasn't always clean water. At one point, there was actually a case in Indiana in which it was pond water.
Pond water.
Pond water, and it was noticed when the family found worms wiggling in the bottle.
And pond water was actually some of the safer stuff that milk was contaminated with.
That's exactly right, because once you had thinned the milk, you had to reconstitute it in all kinds of weird ways. People put chalk dust in it, people put plaster dust in it, people put weird coal tar dyes and sometimes toxic dyes like yellow lead to kind of make it more golden again instead of kind of grayish or bluish. And then, because it was prone to rot, this is before pasteurization and before refrigeration, they would dump preservatives in it, and the most popular one was formaldehyde, which is an embalming compound.
Which is not good for humans to ingest.
No, and so you actually go out and can see newspaper headlines around the country during this period with embalmed milk scandals.
So along comes the protagonist of your story, Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley, and his title is Chief Chemist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Why did he care so much about this issue?
I've always thought of him as kind of a holy roller chemist, right? You have Harvey Washington Wiley was the son of itinerant preacher and farmer in Indiana. Father was a conductor on the Underground Railroad. He was really raised. I mean, he's a real mid-19th century kind of childhood. He was really raised to think of what he did needing to be a higher calling. And he would describe chemistry that way, chemistry in the service of good. And so when he became the chief chemist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, I mean, this is at a period where there is no FDA, there is no Consumer Protection Agency. This tiny group of chemists that he commanded at the Department of Agriculture was it on food safety. He took up that cause.
And your book's title, The Poison Squad, comes from a project that he undertook that really just shows his commitment to this. Describe what the Poison Squad was.
Well, this is an experiment you could never do today because he basically goes out and recruits other people at the Department of Agriculture, especially young clerks, to volunteer to dine very dangerously. And so the idea of the poison squad was that three free meals a day, 7 days a week, super fancy meals. They're cooked by a professional chef. All the ingredients are amazing. And the only catch is you have to agree that half of you at any given period in this experiment are going to be adding capsules that contain suspect food additives. And the other thing about it, when you think, is this crazy or what? You are testing suspected toxic compounds on human volunteers. Was that he felt that was the only way he could deal with this. You had this rising tide of really dangerous food additives. There was no safety regulation. How do I make a case that perhaps this is not a good idea? I'll just test it on people, and so he did.
To no one's surprise, if you feed people formaldehyde or arsenic or lead, they will get sick. And when you demonstrate that, why does it still remain so difficult to outlaw formaldehyde or arsenic or lead in food? Why was it just not an obvious thing that everybody got on board with right away?
And then doesn't that sound like the most logical response? Oh, look, you've poisoned people. Let's get that out of the food supply.
Yeah.
The food industry had been organizing itself to fight regulation, probably at the point that Wiley starts these experiments in 1902. He had been advocating, and working with congressmen to try to get some kind of basic consumer protection regulations out there, if nothing else, labeling. And as he does these experiments, and as they catch national attention, which they did, they were front page news, there were songs and, you know, musical numbers about them. Everyone is suddenly realizing that there is a lot of bad stuff in their food. There's just a lot of bad stuff in their food. And so there's an immediate pushback, right, in which suddenly congressmen who are on the side of food business are getting offered more money, and the food industry actually organizes. They create a food manufacturers association and coalesce against making sure this doesn't happen. And they were phenomenally effective.
And yet, despite these long-fought fights that span decades, today there isn't lead and formaldehyde and arsenic in food the way that there was 100 years ago. Progress really was made.
Yes, once this first food safety law that passed in 1906, 2 years after Wiley finished his famous poison squad experiments, once that law went into place, we started pulling stuff out. Formaldehyde went out. Salicylic acid went out. Borax went out. Arsenic went out, right? You really see government stepping up for some of these extremely dangerous compounds.
Is this book just one big argument in favor of government regulation?
In part, because it certainly should be a reminder that before government regulation, food was a constant, unknown, and often terrifying risk to American consumers and put our lives at risk. But it's also, I hope, just a good story. It's a story of something that I love. I love these kinds of stories. It's a story of a single person who changes the conversation. Right. And I think that's really important, too. We need to remember that someone who is focused and even obsessive and who stands up relentlessly for an issue can actually make a difference. So I hope it works on all those levels.
Deborah Blum's new book is called The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley did write a book, and the book that he wrote, and here's the title of it. You can find it on Amazon, but you can also we're going to give you a click off an address you can go to and download it on a PDF. But anyway, Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley, who fought to make an FDA, the first director, an honest thing. Here's the book that he wrote, the title of it. The History of a Crime Against the Food Law, The Amazing Story of the National Food and Drug Law Intended to Protect the Health of the People, Perverted to Protect Adulteration of Foods and Drugs. So what happens is that these regulatory agencies might start off with good intentions, but ultimately the big industries, which are multi-million, now multi-billion dollars food industry, and especially now the drug industry, the pharmaceutical industry, have taken over and are pressuring and controlling the very regulatory agencies that are meant to protect the public. Now here's a clip from Dr. Tenpenny. Dr. Tenpenny knows, she's an osteopath from Kirksville, School of Osteopath there in Kirksville, Missouri. But she's a fine stand-up lady. We had her down here 1 year, and Dr. Donna Campbell was a moderator for a debate from the, between the Texas Health Department and Tenpenny and two other people siding on the alternative health side against the establishment, health establishment side. And Dr. Campbell, who's a state senator now, was the moderator. But anyway, listen to this. This is a presentation that she gave years ago. I'm just going to give you the first 10 minutes or so to sort of give you a flavor. There will be a click off on our site where you can see the whole video. So here we go with Dr. Tenpenny.
Hello, my name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. Thank you for having an interest in this critically important topic of vaccines, and welcome to the video, Vaccination, What the CDC Documents and Science Reveal. When it comes to the topic of vaccines, most people have an existing belief that vaccines are essential for the health of individuals and for the betterment of society. We believe that vaccines are safe, we trust that they are effective, and we are confident that they will protect our children from deadly infectious diseases. These beliefs have been presented to us as facts, and we accept that they are true. As a result, we unquestioningly submit to vaccines for our children and for ourselves. It never occurs to us to challenge these beliefs or to question whether these premises are true. The tape you are about to see contains material that will challenge those beliefs. It is important for you to know that the information comes directly from scientific journals and from the Centers for Disease Control, the nation's top administrative authority in the area of health. It is the CDC that has jurisdiction over our lives when it makes decisions to mandate vaccines. It is within the CDC's documents that we will find information rarely discussed in the public regarding the truth about vaccines. Statistics have shown that when presented with a new, different, challenging idea, 96% of people will spend all of their time and energy defending their current beliefs, and only 4% will embrace the idea as something to seriously consider. Since you are taking the time to investigate this important issue, I'm confident that you are part of the 4%. It is my sincere hope that you will gain the additional knowledge that you need to make truly informed decisions regarding vaccination, one of the most important decisions you will ever make regarding the health of your family and your own health. Good morning. Thank you all for coming. I want to tell the people who are watching the video, thank you for watching the video. And we are recording this morning in front of a live studio audience. And what we're going to be talking about today is called Vaccination, What the CDC Documents and Science Reveal. Now, when you start talking about vaccination, it's a very large topic. There are many vaccines, and there's also the politics of vaccination. There's the big money about vaccination. There's vaccine injury. There's vaccine promotion. There's vaccine dissent. So there's a whole big area of vaccination to talk about. What we're going to talk about today really has to do with the science and what I've discovered through about 4,000 hours worth of research. Well, how the heck did I get interested in vaccination? Because who I am is a classically trained physician. I'm board certified in emergency medicine. I practiced in an emergency department for 12 years, and not only was I an emergency room physician, I was the director of the ER and president of our ER corporation, and I ran a three-county EMS, and I set up a three-county mental health transportation system that involved the sheriff's department, the police department, and the state highway patrol. So not only did I do every conventional thing that you can imagine in terms of conventional medicine, but when I was an ER doc, I used to hand out tetanus shots like they were some special form of candy. Have people been waiting there for 2 hours because they cut their finger washing dishes? I wasn't going to take the time to go and explain to them that they just had a tetanus shot 3 years ago and they probably didn't need it. I just thought it was something totally benign, a little bit of tetanus toxoid and a little saline, and off, and we'd get them their shot and out the door they went. So how did I get from point A to point B? Because I was obviously way into conventional medicine. Well, in 1994, my business partner and colleague and very dear friend, Dr. Dave Frontzek, died of cancer. And at that point, he was only 33 years old. And my heart sort of went out of emergency medicine, and I thought that there might be a whole lot more to treating people than just patching them up in the ER. And I come from a whole lineage of chiropractors, 3 generations, as a matter of fact. With my grandfather and my father and 3 uncles and 2 cousins as chiropractors, I really wanted to get back to my osteopathic roots and do more in terms of healing people and getting people well, rather than just patching people up. So I started an office practice, and I did the office practice doing osteopathic manipulation and acupuncture 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And I worked in the ER Tuesday, Thursday, and every other weekend. So it was a rather schizophrenic life and very busy, and I did that for a couple of years. And finally one day I said, whoa, what's wrong with this picture? I'm this divorced professional female with no children, living in a married with kids kind of town, working 100 hours a week, and this is getting me nowhere. And if I stayed here another 10 years, how much would that change? Well, it really wasn't going to change a whole lot. So I was getting more and more and more involved in the alternative medicine side of my practice because of the office practice, because people would come in and want helps with their vitamins and supplements and diet and herbs, and they wanted more things than just a prescription to try to make them feel better. So at that point, I moved to Cleveland, and I started OsteoMed 2, and at that time, it was just myself and an office manager, and since then, we've grown to about 16 people, and we're just continuing to expand and grow. Well, it was in September of 2000, I had the opportunity to attend the National Vaccine Information Center meeting in Washington, D.C., and at that point, I went in, and I sat for 4 days listening to a meeting, and I just couldn't even believe my ears. I mean, I'm rather an information junkie, and I read a lot, and I study a lot, and this whole area of medicine was totally new to me. How did I miss this? Well, it just became such a fascination for me because I thought, well, if all these people standing up here with big credentials and really seem to be very knowledgeable are speaking out against vaccines, maybe that's something that I ought to take a look at. So figuring that the best defense is a good offense, I thought that the best place to start was to go to the CDC. Now, the CDC is the Center for Disease Control, and they are what we would call the highest law in the land when it comes to vaccines. Sort of like if you were an attorney and you were investigating and researching a court case, you would want to see what the Supreme Court said about it. You would want to go to the highest law in the land. So when I started going to the CDC documents, I decided that I didn't really have to look many other places because there was so much information in there that was not known to doctors, not known to the general public, and really showed that vaccines did cause a lot of damage and that there was a real reason for concern. So after about the last 3 years of just spending all of my extra time, I mean, my friends who know me say, you know, you have no life because I spend all my evenings reading CDC documents. And so I do that because I'm very passionate about this topic. I believe that we really need to know more about this. I'm very passionate about the vaccine-injured children that we treat in our clinic. And I'm very passionate to do something to get the information out to stop the tide of what's happening in this country in terms of vaccine injury. So we're going to talk about that. We need to find out what the CDC actually really says about vaccines. And what they say is that vaccines are among the nation's most important public health tools. They save lives and money, protect people, and particularly infants and young children, from unnecessary suffering caused by vaccine-preventable diseases, and improve the quality of life for infants, children, adolescents, and adults. Since the introduction of safe and effective vaccines, the United States and most developed countries have experienced at least a 97% reduction in the number of cases of vaccine-preventable diseases of childhood compared to pre-vaccination era. Reported cases of vaccine-preventable diseases in children are at currently record low levels. However, these diseases can readily return if immunization levels decline as a result of complacency or other factors. And I always like to say the other factors are informed people. They're informed people who decide that maybe that really isn't the complete truth. And this whole area here, where we talk about each one of these individual things, I do a 2-day, 14-hour seminar that is a background information on each of the individual vaccines. And when we do, so we spend 14 hours doing this topic, we take each one of these things apart line item and show that there's another side of the story than what you're being told by conventional doctors. Which brings about another point is when people come up to me and say, hey, Sherry, what can you tell me about vaccines? I kind of chuckle and say, we better narrow that down a little bit or we're going to be here a really long time. The other thing that they say about vaccine people who decide they want to get informed is that they're an anti-something. They're an anti-vaccine consumer, and they tend to be those with a child who had a bad reaction, which, of course, could have been a coincidence, and those who believe that the government should not tell them what to do, and those who are increasingly focused on the perceived benefits of alternative medicine. Well, since I've been doing alternative medicine in my practice for 7 years, I know that there's more than just perceived benefits, and I know that some of you here can feel the same way. And this person here, this Dr. Bruce Gellin, is the head of the Vaccine Initiative Pediatric Infectious Disease Society, and this came out in 1999. And I want to tell you that that's pretty much the thinking of the way conventional doctors think about people. It's not that you are a pro-choice consumer. It's not that you want to be informed. It's that you're an anti-something. So I think one of the things that's really important, and I think it's really important to understand early on, is the difference of in a definition. The definition difference between vaccination and immunization, because they're not the same thing. So when you hear people saying that they're going to take their kids to the doctor to get their immunizations, they're really not. What they're really doing is they're taking them to get vaccinated, because what vaccination means, it's a physical act of administering a vaccine. It means going to get a shot. Immunization, on the other hand, means the process of trying to induce artificial immunity. So they're really different. And not only are they different conceptually, even the CDC says that although persons often use vaccination and immunization interchangeably, the terms are not synonymous. The administration of a vaccine, which is what they call an immunobiologic, cannot be automatically equated with the development of immunity. So just because you get a shot doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be immune. Just because you get a shot doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have an antibody, and just because you have an antibody doesn't mean it's going to protect you from disease. And we're going to talk about that a lot more in depth as time goes on. Now, one thing I just want to point out here is you'll see as we go through these slides, you'll see these citations down here at the bottom that start with MMWR. That stands for Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Those are CDC documents that come out every week that talk about various types of disease processes and infectious processes. So every time you see MMWR in any of these slides, you know that that comes directly from a government document. So we've got a really big public health policy here. We've got laws in every state. Now we've got this national umbrella called the Homeland Security Bill that we can ratchet up vaccination, mandatory vaccination to a federal level. We have to have some reason to do this. We have to have some policies behind this. Well, the first one is that vaccines are safe. And it doesn't matter what you read in the public press, if you're reading in the New York Times, if you're reading in some medical journal, that's almost one of the first things that you hear, is the vaccines are safe, and right behind that, that vaccines are effective and the effects are long-lasting. Vaccine benefits include the decline of infectious diseases, and that vaccines are the only way to prevent epidemics of those dangerous diseases. Those dangerous diseases like mumps and chickenpox. Okay, so these are like the public health policy. This is the cornerstone upon which we have formulated our entire public health policy. So we're going to go through today and look at each one of these things and show you that there's another side to this that you may not know.
That was Dr. Tenpenny at a seminar, actually recorded presentation that she gave. We'll have that up on our site. So come into thesecrettruth.com and you can watch it in full from start to finish. But next, I'm going to give you just a short little clip. It was a promotional trailer for Vaxxed, which was a video that just set the whole, you know, standard modern medical model turned it on its head. But anyway, this is just a short clip about autism. Here we go now.
My phone rings, and it's Dr. William Thompson.
You and I don't know each other very well. You have a son with autism, and I have great shame now.
There's a whistleblower from the CDC who's going to come out and say that the CDC had committed fraud on the MMR study and that they knew that vaccines were actually causing autism.
My oldest son, Ian, was walking and running. After the vaccine, he was no longer able to do that.
So I called the clinic and I said, I think my child's had adverse reaction to those shots.
And then came the headbang, constant banging against anything that he could find.
Right now I'm sitting in a very pretty position in terms of providing you a lot of information.
The first thing that Thompson did was to plot a graph. Now, if there's no link between early MMR and autism, those two lines should track together. And they do track together until they get to 15 months. Then they separate, and they continue to separate thereafter. And they sliced and diced the data in an effort to get rid of that effect.
The relative risk of receiving an autism diagnosis was astronomical.
Wow. The CDC had known all along there was this MMR autism risk.
In CDC's judgment, the best public policy is to continue vaccination unchanged.
You who run our health agencies in this country, you have an obligation to make sure that these studies are complete, thorough, so that we have all the facts.
Oh my God, I cannot believe we did what we did. But we did.
Omission of crucial data, destruction of documents, misleading the Congress, grievous harm to innocent children.
Everything I've been telling my patients for the last 10 years has been based on a lie and a cover-up.
Parents should be able to count on federal agencies to tell them the truth.
In 1978, the prevalence of autism was about 1 in 15,000 children. If we assume that things are going to continue as they have, we can predict that by 2032, 80% of the boys born will end up on the autism spectrum. Half the children, 80% of the boys.
It's a vast number of children who are being diagnosed with autism every day.
This is going to be a complete catastrophe if we just let it happen.
Those were real parents in there on that clip who had damaged children by medical treatment. That's called iatrogenesis, by the way, is the term. And it means to induce ill health or death by medical treatment. According to some surveys and so forth in the China book, I think, they listed as the third largest cause of death in the United States, the medical treatment, coming after cancer and heart disease. So this goes unreported a lot, so it's hard to get a handle on how many deaths are caused by medical, you know, malpractice, you could say. But one of the little insights that Alex Jones has brought to us recently is Danielle Anderson, who has been working at the Wuhan before. I think she's working for the Duke Medical Organization in Singapore now. But he recently exposed the fact that that she was working for Wuhan and then working in Singapore, but also she's one of the editors, the science editors for Facebook. So Alex just exploded when he heard this. Listen to what Alex has to say about this.
Guess who runs Facebook's science division, runs it, and decides what you can say about zinc, vitamin D, hydroxychloroquine? Who says on Facebook that the president's a liar and there's no hope? Only Bill Gates can save you. One of the top scientists at the Wuhan Bioweapons Lab. Wow! You can't make this up. They've hired Stasi. They've hired Chi-Coms. They run it. And now Dr. Danielle Anderson, one of the top scientists at the Wuhan lab with U.S. Bill Gates funding, says AP is banned. Does it matter if a whistleblower released the documents? No, 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 dirty Americans. You keep your filthy mouth shut and you stay in your house with the 5G towers going in and you wait for Bill Gates coming with his forced shot. You will take it. Do you understand, filthy scum? I want nothing more than humanity to defeat this AI. 5G positronic genetic engineer warfare takeover. If we don't succeed, not one child will have a future. The extermination has begun. The incremental ambient background noise of the electromagnetic radiation is being jacked up on high. All over the world, people are watching 5G go in by their house and the trees die within weeks. The grass begins to gnarl and brown. The birds move their nest. And the studies are coming out everywhere that the 5G towers are 3, 4, 5, 10 times stronger than even the FCC says they're allowed to have. And at the FCC agreed level, massive increases in cancer. Oh, you're burning inside now. That microwave's rubbing your molecules together. And you're burning inside. And soon you will die. And the globalists think you're so stupid that when you're all dying, you won't even notice it. You ready to die? Hope so, because you're dying right now. Let's lay it out, ladies and gentlemen. All over the place, people are putting up time-lapse footage and photos of it going in and the trees dying. And it's in the studies they do that with the older systems that weren't as strong. They're pouring in from Maryland and Texas and California. People that didn't even believe it openly see it.
He's right on top of this with a lot of other people. But recently, Dr. Group out of Houston Global Health Center gave a live presentation this week. Here's what he said about 5G.
So now what they have is what's called WiGig. And WiGig is a wireless standard designed to encourage high wireless speeds. So traditional wireless uses about 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz bands. I mean, there's all kinds of bands we'll get into as well, megahertz bands. But the WiGig is designed to use a 60 gigahertz bandwidth to transmit information. Just to give you a little bit of information up front, guess what? 60 gigahertz messes with the oxygen absorption, and it also messes with iodine. Actually, 6 gigahertz range messes with iodine. It's when you think about and you start researching, and by the way, on this document, I have the links to all the research behind this. So I'm not just going to sit here and talk and give you a bunch of stuff without providing you the evidence behind it. You can post. So use this video and post the documentation, post the link so everybody can share and everybody can get this. 5G technology is being called a unified connectivity fabric. Anybody remember the Matrix? Think about that. And that's the way it's listed from the International Telecommunications Union. A unified connectivity fabric. Their goal is to support 100 billion. Listen, all this stuff on the document I'm sharing with you was actually from a long time ago. I finished putting a lot of this together in May of 2018. Okay? This is old information. I know there's videos out there floating around on YouTube and everywhere else saying that I was the one that predicted, or one of the people that predicted everything that's happening now from the videos I was putting out in 2018. Everything is coming to fruition. Their goal was to support 100 billion devices by 2020. Guess what year it is? 2020. They wanted to do this in the saturate the urban areas. They wanted to move people into the cities, and they're supplanting that. What they wanted to do is support at 1 million devices per square kilometer. Can you imagine? 1 million devices per square kilometer. So, at the millimeter wave frequency of 60 gigahertz, this was taken directly from rfglobalnet.com. At the millimeter wave frequency of 60 gigahertz, the absorption is very high, with 98% of the transmitted energy absorbed by oxygen. Does that sound strange to you that most people right now that are suffering and going into the hospitals are suffering from pulmonary? Doctors are doing videos and coming out and saying that patients are walking in with blood oxygen levels in the 70s, that they shouldn't even be walking. They should be in a coma. But yet they're walking in and they're full of energy and they're wondering what's going on. Does that sound strange? I mean, these doctors are posting videos. I mean, what's going on with that? While oxygen absorption at 60 gigahertz severely limits the range, okay, it limits the range of 60 gigahertz, it also eliminates interference. And for millimeter waves, the primary absorption molecules, this is a millimeter wave, same as the TSA body scanners that people just go walk through and just sit in all the time and let their bodies get, you know, blown to pieces by frequency waves, not even knowing that it's harming them. This also affects water, oxygen, CO2, and ozone. And the FCC has allocated the millimeter wave RF spectrum, radio frequency spectrum, from 57.05 to 64 gigahertz for unlicensed use. Okay? Under Part 15. All wireless equipment operating at 60 gigahertz must obtain FCC Part 15 type certification. Once certified, which they are, the product can be deployed license free. Okay? Throughout the United States. The unlicensed frequency spectrum allows the end user to avoid the added cost of regional spectrum auctions held by the FCC. Due to the unique characteristics of the 60 gigahertz millimeter wave region, wireless communication at 60 gigahertz offers a reliable, listen to this, last mile alternative to installing physical fiber. They can be used for a variety of applications, including metropolitan area networks, campus networks, network backbones, network branch links, temporary emergency restoration, and local access. Now, I don't know if it's true, but I got a video, watched a video the other day that during this time when people are locked down, they are testing and installing and making the final adjustments to all of these 60 gigahertz millimeter wave systems everywhere, from your street lights to your power lines to everything. This is common sense, common sense. Tesla, as well as Einstein, as well as many other scientists, have 100% confirmed that we are an electrical, vibrational, energetic being. Masaru Emoto in Messages from Water said, there's nothing as damaging to water as electromagnetic frequencies. And we and every living substance on the planet is composed of water, oxygen, we breathe out CO2, and ozone is what cleans our air. So, the FCC is moving quickly to adapt 5G technology. Verizon and AT&T started 5G trials in 2017 with the first commercial deployments in 2020. They noted that all areas, including rural communities, will be saturated. Listen to the terminology that they use. In other words, no part of the country will be safe. No part of the country will be safe from ultra high frequency signals. Ultra high frequency signals. Now let's go back a little bit. In 2016, the U.S. became the first nation to allocate a large swath of airwaves for 5G. Those services could be available to consumers by, guess what, 2020. Offering transmission speeds of at least 10 times faster than 4G. 5G is planned to extend the FCC's current policy of mandatory irradiation of the public. The FCC's current policy of mandatory, is that unconstitutional? Mandatory irradiation of the public. It is planned that 5G will rely on the UN constitutional and criminal 1996 Telecommunications Act, signed by Bill Clinton. If you don't know and you're not familiar with the Telecommunications Act, it was signed in 1996. Go look at right to bar the installation of wireless technology on environmental and health grounds. Are you kidding me? What do you think 5G and harmful radiation does? It destroys the environment. It destroys your health. But they're banning local governments, state governments, municipalities, the right to refuse 5G and wireless technology on the grounds of environmental and health. I mean, is that the craziest thing that you've heard or what?
This stuff is scary, this 5G, and Dr. Group was right on top of it. We're going to end up with a clip from American Countdown. It's a new program that Robert Barnes is the host for. But here we go with the over extraordinary power grab that the Fed has just effected. Here we go with Robert Barnes, American Countdown.
Meanwhile, let's continue to look at what the economic consequences are. And those consequences include the extraordinary pretext this has offered to provide a massive power grab by the Federal Reserve in ways that people are not fully monitoring and watching. So while these various petty tyrants who were once called sheriffs or mayors or governors have asserted extraordinary king-like powers and monarchical authority across the country from Nevada to Michigan, what's happening in those local governments? They're going broke. Indeed, as this headline from The Hill says, far worse to come, COVID-19 collapse of state and local governments. They're talking about how wages won't be paid, services won't be delivered, institutions will shut down abruptly. Many state colleges may completely fold. People have lost jobs, homes, savings, retirement incomes that may never return. Owners of rental property can't pay. Owners of other property can't pay property tax. Sales tax is down. Property tax is down. State income tax is down. All the means of revenue to support the everyday functioning of local government is disappearing and vanishing. So what are they having to do? They have two choices. One is to slash budgets. The other is to increase their municipal lending. But who's going to lend money to someone that has even less ability to pay off that debt? Well, that's why the Fed has announced that it is going into the municipal bond market, and it's going to start buying municipal bonds. What does that mean? It means the Federal Reserve may own your town, may own your city, may own your county, heck, may even own your state when this is all said and done. That means the Federal Reserve will get to dictate what policies your city or your county or state will get to follow. Not you, the voters, not you, the citizens, not you, the property taxpayers. Instead, they'll decide what you should spend on schools, what you should spend on parks, what you should spend on roads, what you should spend on safety and security. And look at what the IMF and the International Monetary Fund has done around the world to governments that default or go into debt there. And what you'll see is elite-driven, banker-driven governments that lead to things like what happened to Greece over the past half decade or so. So that's the danger that we face as we have our electoral processes undermined by these petty tyrants, ultimately in service of the big bankers and the financial elites and Wall Street and the Federal Reserve, having more and more and more concentrated, monopolized power. While at the same time, because places like, in cities like Detroit, supposed to be having an epidemic, supposed to be a next epicenter of the epidemic, it's the excuse and the pretext for why it is that the Michigan is under their extreme shutdown order, which doesn't allow you to travel between residences, doesn't allow you to invite people outside of your household into your own home, doesn't allow you to go to a home of a friend or family member unless they're part of the same household, doesn't allow you to buy seeds at the local grocery store, doesn't allow you to buy an American flag at your local store, doesn't allow you to do a wide range of activities unless the governor unilaterally declares them essential activities. Even activities that are declared essential as critical infrastructure, either under federal law or comparable state law, is not being considered essential in the state of Michigan. Well, what's happening because of this economic shutdown, because of this cash crunch for local, city, county, and state governments? Well, the Detroit Medical Center, in the middle of this pandemic, supposed to be an epicenter, supposed to be making that they're supposed to have this hospital overcapacity problem. But what's the Detroit Medical Center do? It's furloughing people. It's laying people off. In fact, the Detroit Medical Center announced Wednesday, today, it will furlough at least 480 employees. It announced that the stay-at-home orders forced multiple operations to either be temporarily closed or completely ramped down. So our medical care services are going to become less and less and less available in the name of protecting the health of the community. Is this wise, sound policy to continue any further? Was it ever? Well, in the same context, we have what's going on in the federal markets and in the global markets. In an article popularly entitled Down the Rabbit Hole, the Euro Dollar Market is the Matrix Behind It All, that you can find either at Rabobank or at Zero Hedge. It goes into the huge structural pressures and the profound paradigm shift that is occurring, reflected in swap lines for foreign currencies and in repo facilities. Now, the Euro Dollar, what that is that's the U.S. dollar outside of the United States. That's all that really means. And what it is you have a bunch of foreign companies, a bunch of foreign countries, a bunch of foreign banks that do all of their transactions, that have a lot of their debt, that have a lot of their trade denominated in the dollar. And often they're putting massive pressure on the dollar. And the problem is that a lot of these, there's not enough dollars in circulation to meet the demand and need for these economic transactions or debt if somebody calls it. It's like a classic bank run scenario. If all of a sudden all these foreign countries or all these foreign governments or all these foreign businesses or foreign banks suddenly had the need or in fear that they needed the dollars now in order to pay a debt or satisfy a trade obligation, there simply isn't enough dollars to meet it. And they could completely crash the global economy due to the U.S. dollar being the reserve currency of the world. So what is the Fed doing to deal with this? The Fed is putting trillions and trillions of dollars into the swaps, where basically a foreign bank can exchange its currency for the U.S. dollar on favorable terms to help these foreign countries, foreign businesses, foreign corporations, and foreign banks get bailed out. So you're going to have the Federal Reserve bailing out foreign countries and foreign banks and foreign businesses, including potentially trillions of dollars to China and Chinese businesses and Chinese banks. Does that make sense politically? We're going to spend trillions and trillions of dollars to bail out the Chinese? Well, there's big talk from aspects of the conservative movement against China. I don't think many of them recognize or realize what is happening behind the scenes and how the more consequential economic policy decision making is happening at the Federal Reserve right now. That's where I highly recommend this article. It gives you information that's both accessible and actionable in terms of being able to understand what's happening. You don't have to be an economics or currency expert to understand and get the basic core of what's taking place. Ultimately, what could the net effect of all of this be? Well, let me give you some descriptions that are from the article. Every import, bond, loan, credit guarantee, or derivative often needs to be settled in U.S. dollars by banks and corporations around the world. What could be the net effect of this? The Federal Reserve could take over the entire global financial system by controlling the means by which everybody has their debt satisfied and their trade dealt with. They could effectively, by printing more dollars, control not only your local government in the United States, but increasingly control foreign governments and foreign corporations around the world. Basically, this could be the biggest power grabber of all. Might not be the mayor of Los Angeles or the governor of Michigan. It may instead be the Federal Reserve, which may have a degree of power and control unheard of. This is happening while the Fed is buying up United States equities. What are equities? It's a fancy phrase for the stock in U.S. corporations. They're also can be buying up mortgage-backed securities. What does that mean? That's the way your mortgage ends up being bought and sold under a legal principle called holder in due course to the Wall Street markets that led and precipitated the first crash in 2008. So what we have is a situation where the Fed may own your home, at least the mortgage on your home. The Fed may own every major U.S. business and control your employment, control what products get produced. The Fed may control your local city, county, and state government. The Fed may control the entire foreign economic and banking structure if this keeps going unabated, unmitigated, unquestioned, and uncontested as it is currently. Well, there's been some resistance and some pushback. Today, there were protests in Michigan. There's more protests planned in Pennsylvania, protests planned in Texas, protests planned across the country in resistance. In fact, more and more people are forming groups called Against Excessive Quarantine. They could really just call it Against Quarantine, period, because the quarantine that's happening is not a quarantine. It is mass house arrest. But they're phrasing it in different ways for different groups, whether it's called Reopen Pennsylvania or Get Our Jobs Back or Against Excessive Quarantine in both Pennsylvania and Michigan. Mass protests are forming all across the country, enough so that the four sheriffs in Michigan decided that they were not going to enforce the unconstitutional orders being imposed by the petty tyrant, petty dictator, monarchical governor of Michigan, and who also imagines that she's going to be the next vice presidential nominee for either Biden or Cuomo, depending on who it ends up really being, depending on political circumstances. Well, these four sheriffs issued a press release. And that press release said that the current framework of emergency laws are vague, obscure, and contradictory, and, quote, only confuse Michigan citizens. As a result, these four sheriffs committed that they will not have strict enforcement of these orders. Indeed, these four sheriffs stood up to the constitutional oath that each of them took and said they would remain, the quote, the last line of defense in protecting your civil liberties, unquote. They said their focus will be, and they believe the focus of the governors and the mayors and including the president need to be on reopening our country, reopening our county, reopening our economy to promote jobs and civil society. The anti-shutdown protest that is planned to take place in front of the state capitol building that did take place in Michigan today. There's plans of it in Austin, in Texas, potentially, depending on what the governor does this week. There's also now anti-shutdown protest planned to take place in front of the state capitol building in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where Pennsylvanians Against Excessive Quarantine have been adding thousands and thousands and thousands of members, just like the Michigans Against Excessive Quarantine have been adding thousands and thousands and thousands of members. And you're seeing cities, counties, states form their own organization Against Excessive Quarantine to take a lead in that capacity across the country, just as you're seeing more lawyers bring more suits, more civil rights cases, more challenges to these constitutionally questionable and constitutionally dubious orders infringing on First, Second, Fourth, Fifth Amendment rights of ordinary everyday Americans. And in this context, people have evaluated what we're going to be talking about in the bottom half of the hour, which is what should be the next objective of the President of the United States. Should it be to encourage, incentivize, and reward those governors, mayors that reopen their economies and civil societies? Or should it be to continue down a path of shutdown? We'll be debating that with Will Chamberlain. As one article today from Angela Codvilla pointed out, the integrity of the numbers regarding infections and deaths remain in doubt and in question. So we should always be skeptical of those who wish us to surrender our goods and freedoms in exchange for salvation by the state. There's a long and notorious and dubious history of the state when it makes that challenge that it gives to us. And then increasingly, as he points out, many of the decisions made, many of the policies enacted, many of the proposals propounded simply appear to be those who hold positions of power exercising their purported authority in excess of that express authority, to please themselves or to act out their dreams of power. And who is particularly happy about his dream of power right now? Well, in the next hour, we'll talk about him in greater detail. But that would be meet the world's most powerful doctor, according to Politico Europe. That man is Bill Gates, who has neither a college degree nor a medical degree. It goes into detail about how Gates' priorities have become the World Health Organization's priorities. Is it any surprise, then, that Bill Gates was critical of President Trump today for attempting to defund the World Health Organization? that increasingly people have noted that you have to be allied with Bill Gates in order to get any public health policy done.
I'm going to play about 4 minutes here of Amazing Polly. It'll be up on our site also. She's just doing amazing things. Amazing Polly, here we go.
We're going to talk about profiting from panic today, and I've got a lot to go through. Generally, it looks like this. We're going to talk about Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has been on a tear against Bill Gates lately. It's been inspiring and fascinating, and I'm going to read what he posted on his Instagram account later in the video. We're also going to look at Dr. Scott Jensen, who happens to be a senator from Minnesota, and he's talking about the reporting requirements that he got handed not too long ago, among other things, and that relates to the statistics that they're gathering for this COVID-19 or the coronavirus deaths. I want to show you how the reporting around ordinary flu has been falsified for years and purposely weaponized to create a huge predatory industry that makes its money and usurps control through bad data and false panic. It seems to have begun in the early 2000s, just after Bill Gates was brought into what they call global health. Then there was an explosion of investment in this area by so-called philanthropists and non-governmental organizations, humanitarian organizations, and so-called charities. According to reports in 2004, the Centers for Disease Control became the de facto vaccine marketing board. I will show you that in this video. And it purposefully came up with a plan to induce demand for vaccines. So in the video, we're going to have clips from Bill Gates, clips from Deborah Birx, clips from a lot of people. And there's also going to be a significant amount of reading in this one. Mr. Bajoman, at Bajoman73 on Twitter, sent me this article from the Huffington Post, which was from 2014. Don't believe everything you read about flu deaths. The article basically argues that the flu death, the normal flu death numbers going way back in time, started to be inflated, like greatly inflated, because the news was relying on statistics that were generated by some sketchy death certificate entries, which then contributed to bad computer modeling, which then led to horribly inflated flu death statistics. He then goes on to describe why that number doesn't reflect medical reality, showing that the 1-2 punch of faulty computer modeling, along with a 7-step recipe for generating demand for vaccines, has changed the world's approach to vaccination. That's right, it's purposeful. And I'll show that as we go along. The CDC's decision to play up flu deaths dates back a decade when it realized the public wasn't following its advice on the flu vaccine. During the 2003 flu season, the manufacturers were telling us that they weren't receiving a lot of orders for vaccines, says Dr. Glenn Novak, Associate Director for Communications at CDC's National Immunization Program. At the time this author wrote this article, NBC was reporting that the flu deaths from just regular influenza were 36,000 a year in the United States. But that number has been called controversial because they're based on estimates. The author says, controversial is an understatement. The numbers differ wildly from the sober tallies recorded on death certificates.
That's it tonight. Good night. God bless each and every one of you.